All right, thank you, Elise. Hope you guys are all doing well. As you said, my name is Matt DeGerald, and I'm a graduate student here at the University of Michigan studying materials science and engineering. And I would like to share with you some of my research in nanotechnology and how these nanostructures and nanoelectronics can do some pretty amazing things, and such as one day hopefully helping you communicate with your refrigerator. So, in 2007, Apple did a revolutionary thing when they introduced the first iPhone. For most people, this was the first time that they had ever used the internet on a medium outside of their computer. And at the time, a lot of people thought it was going to be a fad, but they could not have been more wrong, as society as a whole is extremely dependent and integrated with their smartphones now. In fact, how many of you have used your smartphone within the past hour? Within the past 10 minutes? How many of you are on your phone right now? So that goes to show you how integrated this smart technology has become within our society. And this process is only going to increase, for better or worse. As we can see with new technologies coming out, such as Google's Google Glass, the Apple iWatch, and Google's smart driving car. Now, some of you may have seen this movie. In 1999, Disney released this movie called Smart House. And in it, the Cooper family bought a new home. And the home was amazing. It could do everything. The house could clean up spills on the floor automatically. It would give you food just by talking to it. And it could analyze your diet based on the molecules in your breath. Eventually, the house went evil, and they had to shut it down to save everyone's lives. But at the time, that technology was very fantasy, futuristic. It didn't seem like it could be real. But today, that technology is becoming more and more feasible. Everything except the evil part. Scientists are still working that part out. So let's take a look at what a smart house of today could look like. To start off, you could have a roof that could automatically tell you different weather updates or different atmospheric conditions. You could have a window that would automatically draw the curtains or polarize based on the light intensity that's coming through. You could have a bathroom that could automatically to warn you of any health changes that might occur way before you would ever go to a doctor. You laugh, but it would actually be pretty useful. You could have a door that would be remotely controlled from your smartphone. And security systems are going to become more and more common as this technology progresses, and the video feed is going to go directly to your smart devices like your iPhone. You could have a table that would automatically heat up or cool down based on what you put on top of it. And finally, you could have a refrigerator that could warn you if you have moldy food or if your food is emptying out and give you notifications on what you need to buy. In fact, it's hard to think of any sort of technology or any sort of appliance that you use today that couldn't be turned into a smart device. Now, if we want to have a smart house and have all these smart appliances, we need to have sensors everywhere. We need to have sensors all over the house. And what a sensor is a sensor is a piece of technology that allows the computer to interact with the environment around it, much like how we use our five senses to interact with the environment around us. Now, sensors are not new technology. In fact, you use them every day. You have sensors in your car that can tell you if something is broken or how fast you're going, if you're out of gas. You have sensors in fish tanks that can tell you the nutrients that are in the water. There's sensors in your thermostat that tell you what temperature it is. And everyone's favorite, you have sensors in your scales that can measure how many cupcakes you eat. Now, if we do have all these sensors, we put sensors all over the house, it really is, much like the Disney movie, it's going to turn that house alive. But the problem is, if we want to have these sensors everywhere, these sensors need to be small and they need to be wireless. Now, some of the market leaders of these sensors technology are on this slide here. And I've put a penny up here for scale with regards to their size. We have Ant Plus. They have a wireless sensor for fitness tracking and a lot of wearable electronics, really popular right now. This is Monit sensor that can measure whether or not a door is open or closed or something along that sense. And here's wireless sensor tag sensor that is both a temperature and a motion sensor. And with regards to that penny, those sensors are pretty small. If you put them somewhere, they wouldn't be noticeable. But if we really want to have a smart house, we don't want to see them at all. They need to be inconspicuous. They need to be fluent with what we do. We don't want them to get in the way. That's how we work. So let's make a list of what is necessary if we want to really create a smart house and what we need in these sensors. As I had mentioned, they need to be small. They also need to be wireless. We can't really be plugging in a sensor into the wall for every sort of smart device that we have. They need to be solar powered, or at least powered from the light in the room, or the solar power outside. They need to be online or have some sort of communication with each other so your sensors and smart devices can communicate with one another and send updates directly to your smartphone, or in the case of the smart house, plot against you. And last and probably most importantly, they need to be affordable. That is arguably, in all engineering, some of the most important quality. Now, our colleagues here at the University of Michigan, Professor David Blau and Yunmyung Lee, have done a fantastic job of achieving almost all of these. You can see their millimeter cubed sensor there sitting on a penny. So if we take a look at that sensor and compare it to the sensors on the previous slide, that's a lot smaller, and that's really good. They've done a fantastic job at making these. However, they're missing one vital aspect, and that's being affordable. And to understand why these sensors aren't necessarily affordable for mass production yet, let's take a closer look at that sensor itself. So here is a high-quality schematic of the sensor. And what the sensor is comprised of multiple components. We can see on the top there's a solar cell. That's to get power for the sensor. There's a sensor component itself, so it can interact with the environment. You have a battery to store energy. And then you have the radio or Wi-Fi antenna. So again, it can communicate outwards with your smartphone or computer or whatever type of device. And the way that this is made is they literally make each component separately, or they buy each component separately, and they glue them on top of each other. So they're not connected electrically, they're glued on top of each other. And then to connect them electrically, they do wire bonding. They bond little wires from each layer to another layer in order to have all the electrical connections that are necessary for the device. And when you're working with something that small, this process is really expensive. It's not like you're going into a lab and someone's putting super glue on top of a chip and gluing each piece together. They send this off and have it produced, and it's a costly process. So where does nanotechnology come in? How can nanotechnology make this better? If this is state of the art, what's nanotechnology going to do? Well, the research that I'm working on, hopefully, will take a sensor that looks like this and turn it into this. So we're significantly making it smaller and using less wires, making less manufacturing steps, making it cheaper. So how do we do this? Well, let's start with the sensor itself. Previously, on the last slide, we had the sensor and there was a solar cell glued on top of it. Well, instead of gluing a solar cell on top of it and wire bonding it externally, what if we could just deposit the solar cell directly on top of the sensor? And that's exactly what nanowires allow you to do. So if we deposit nanowires just like that, did any of you see that? Probably not, because they're really small. So what we would be able to do is deposit these nanowires directly on top of the sensor. The nanowires would be electrically connected to the sensor beneath it, and we would eliminate the topmost layer and the manufacturing step necessary to connect the sensor to the solar cell. This would make it both smaller and cheaper to manufacture. And each one of these nanowires will act like its own solar cell. So this is great. Nanowires can make the sensors cheaper, they can make them smaller. But what exactly are nanowires and how are they made? Well, some of you have seen this before, or seen this when you're a kid, some sort of crystal growing kit. And nanowires are crystals too, and they actually are created in a very similar way in how this kit works. So for those of you who haven't seen this kit or worked with one of these kits before, let's go ahead and walk through how this works. Usually in the kit, you come with some sort of basin or petri dish, and you fill it up with water. And in the water, you put in a crystal source material. In a lot of cases, you can use something like sugar or salt, and you put a lot in there. You really saturate that solution. And then you take a substrate, such as a rock or a paper clip or a string, and you place it in the water, and then you wait. And over time, the crystal begins to nucleate on top of the rock. And if you wait even longer, the crystal grows, and you get a nice little crystal covering whatever you put inside that solution as the water evaporates out. Here's some examples of what that looks like. Here's someone who has some multicolored rocks in their petri dish. Here's another person who made some sort of cactus rock thing. And here's rock candy. And I imagine many of you probably remember rock candy or have had rock candy at some point. And rock candy is made in the exact same fashion, except instead of a rock, you use a string or a stick, and you put sugar in the water, and the sugar evaporates out. You put food colored in there, and you get rock candy. Now, nanowires are actually made in a very similar way, give or take $1 million or so. Instead of the petri dish, we use something called an MBE chamber. And this is the chamber that we use, and all the crystal growth occurs inside of there. The MBE stands for molecular beam epitaxy, but the more common word for it is million buck equipment or mostly broken equipment. Instead of the crystal source material, sugar or salt, we use heavy metals like gallium or aluminum or arsenic, and these are the purest form of those elements. Instead of a rock as a substrate, we use a semiconductor wafer. So if any of you remember those Intel commercials that they used to have with those guys in the bunny suits dancing around holding big circles, that's what these are. They work with semiconductor wafers, and that's exactly what these are. We grow on top of those, and these are our rock in that sense. So as I said, all of the crystal growth occurs inside of the chamber. And this chamber is at an extremely high vacuum. For every molecule that is in the chamber, there's about 10 trillion outside of the chamber. And the substrate, the semiconductor wafer, sits right in the middle. Opposite the substrate is a multiple containers that hold a single source material. So you can see down there, there's a yellow, blue, and a red, and a green. And each one of those might have gallium or one might have arsenic. And those get really hot. They get to really high temperatures. So those elements can vaporize off. And so say we have our substrate sitting in the middle, and we want to put gallium on top of the substrate. We want to grow gallium. Well, let's say gallium is blue. We open the blue door, and there's a door in front of each container. We open the door, and gallium vaporizes out, goes on top of the substrate, and we grow gallium. Say we want red material, we open the red door. Say we want red and green, we open both of the doors. Well, we want all the colors, we open all the doors. And by changing the temperature and how fast we deposit the material and the type of materials that we use, we can create really neat structures. And that's how we create the nanowires. And that's how the nanowires form, and that's how crystal growth occurs. So very much like that crystal growth kit. So as I had mentioned, now we know how nanowires are grown, and we know that they're going to be great for the sensors. And I stressed that they were small. But how small are they? Most people, I have an intuitive understanding of how small nano is, but I imagine most of you don't really work with nano things on a daily basis. So let's take a look at exactly how small these solar cells are going to be on top of these new sensors. One nanowire is about 50 nanometers across and 1 micrometer tall. And for comparison, the average flu virus, which hopefully none of you guys have, is about the same size, 50 nanometers across. Say you wanted to cover the back of your iPhone 5, not the 6, not the new one, the iPhone 5. Cover the back of that with nanowire solar cells. How many nanowires could you cover? It would be on the order of 1 trillion nanowires covering the back of that iPhone 5. In fact, these nanowires are so small that you need to use a special microscope just to see them. So here they are. This is what the nanowires look like. Here's a black and white image of the nanowires. And as you can see, they look like pillars extending up into the surface. They go in every which direction. They collide into each other. And they're long. And they're exactly what you might have expected. In fact, they kind of look like a field of grass, except the grass are nanowires, and the field is a semiconductor wafer. So I've been stressing how small they are, but just from this picture, it's hard to get a very good understanding of exactly how small we're dealing with here. So let's go back to our penny analogy that we used earlier on the other sensors. And I want to show you how much space that those nanowires would take up on this Abraham Lincoln penny here, as opposed to non-Abraham Lincoln pennies. So let's zoom in on Abraham Lincoln's nose. Zoom in even further. And do you guys see that? Actually, you guys probably don't see that at all. There's a red dot right there in the center. And that space, that small, tiny space, that's how much space those nanowires in this image would take up. So they're extremely small, smaller than you probably thought of. In fact, they're so small that with the help of this nanowire technology, we would be able to create sensors that we could actually implant underneath our skin. And so say you're an army general and you want to monitor your soldier's health out on the field or your health statuses. Or say you're a mom and you get a notification when your child gets hurt at soccer practice. That is the next step of sensor technology, is being able to actually put these sensors underneath our skin and giving us vital updates. It's kind of scary, but kind of cool. That being said, this nanowire technology is really going to push the sensor technology, and this whole idea of connecting everything together, us as people, smart devices and everything, is a movement that's been called the Internet of Things. And for better or worse, it's coming, and it's going to be, and really, it's the next step in technology and what we're going to get used to. Basically, everything is going to be connected online. And nanotechnology is going to be a big part of that. And we have shown that nanowires can be used to make new smart devices with these sensors. And with these smart devices, we'll be able to create a, much like the Disney movie, a smart house. And it seems that science at long last can actually create smart people as well. Thank you.